For the week of September 6th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 294, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on Broadway in New York City, I'm Michael Gills.
Well, it's a good thing you're on Broadway, especially for this week's show.
Because the neon lights are bright there?
Yes, as a matter of fact. And if I knew the rest of the words to that song, I would have been, it would have been much better, because then I could have followed it up and I would have looked like I know.
Maybe you should go see the musical Beautiful, the Carole King story, because that song is featured in there briefly.
Oh, that's true. I should see that. Is that still showing on Broadway?
It is. Jesse Mueller's not there anymore. I don't know how the replacement is yet, but if I hear some news, I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, you know what? If you want to let us know something, you can by sending us an email, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page will come up. As a matter of fact, that's a way a lot of people contact us.
That's right. And if they're listening to this show this week, and I'm sure they are, what will we be talking about?
Well, in this week's episode, we're discussing a number of news stories that claim there may be something rotten in the state of China. I bet you thought I was going to say Denmark, right?
I did.
Yeah. Well, at least the Chinese box office, there might be something rotten at, because it has already surpassed its record $4.7 billion box office from last year. However, some Chinese producers and even moviegoers are wondering about the accuracy of reported grosses.
We'll not for the box office, but for individual movies.
Yeah, that's right. As we move into autumn here in the Northern Hemisphere, we enter a time when the leaves fall from the trees and Broadway shows fall from the marquees to make way for new shows, finally admitting they are not a hit, a palpable hit. We'll tell you which shows have announced their closing, which ones will follow soon, and take a brief look at the new crop coming in. Oh, we'll also talk about Apple's big announcement, by the way, because, well, I think legally we have to. They just had the biggest quarter in history for a publicly held company. But what's past is prologue, where investors are concerned, and they're not leaping up in excitement over the new product lines. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And ni hao, Sperling, by the way. Maybe we should do the whole show in Mandarin.
Well, you know what I would say to that is Gesundheit.
All right. We're looking at box office around the world. We get our info from Rent Track. We have a link to their site in our show notes. We also pull from Box Office Profits and Mojo and The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, Variety, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, again, is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, the Tom Cruise franchise. Another $95 million around the world. It's at $612 million and counting. It has now quadrupled its budget, which was roughly $155 million. Mind you, Tom Cruise gets a nice chunk of the back end, I'm sure about that. But this is now the second biggest Mission Impossible film of all time. And now that it's open to big in China, it may have a chance to become the biggest Mission Impossible film of all time.
Well, not really, because, it might become the biggest Mission Impossible film of all time, but China didn't necessarily help it, because somehow, despite all those ticket sales, it still wound up number two for the week.
What?
Well, right, isn't that one of our news stories here?
No.
About the box office and...
But China, it was number one in China. There was no movie that grossed more this week.
Oh, Terminator Genesis. I'm so sorry. I was completely mistaken. You're absolutely right.
Okay, yes. So this Tom Cruise film, this is his biggest opening weekend in China ever, right?
Okay. Is it his only opening weekend in China?
No. It's his biggest opening weekend in any territory in the entire world ever. He's never had a bigger opening weekend, not in the U.S., not in North America, not in Europe. You know, this is it. This is the biggest opening weekend for him of all time. 30 years into his career, that's pretty amazing.
Well, maybe, in China, people were coming out to see what all the fuss was about.
Well, no, I'm just saying China is a big market. It's not that. It's saying China's a big market. You know, movies open bigger than ever. So you would expect a movie he opens today to make more than Top Gun did when that was a big hit opening up back, 30 years ago. But here we are, well into his career. This just shows how big a market China is. They really are on fire at the box office, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And now I don't know whether you want to talk about that now or later after we run through the numbers.
Well, let's do China. Let's just stay on China.
Okay. Well, I guess since we're talking about China, and since I just totally butchered that last story about Terminator Genesis, let's first talk about maybe how much money they're making. It's $4.7 billion in September. Last year, they made $4.7 billion the entire year. So they're 4 months ahead of where they needed to be.
Well, they made it as of September. That's right. China set a record for its box office, its annual box office of $4.7 billion, and the year's not even close to over yet. That's about 50% more than they made last year. That's how they're tracking. And it looks like they're going to hit $6 billion by the end of the year. And so now they're predicting in 3 years, the Chinese box office will pass North America and be the number one market in the world, which makes sense. They got a billion people compared to our 330 million.
Well, that's true. And I guess if you take all of North America, it's like 450 million or something.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I forgot Canada.
Yeah.
And my mom's from Canada. Sorry. They're like, oh, no, it's no bother. It's all right. Another big box office news. The number one film of all time in China is now a Chinese film. Instead of Fast and Furious 7, it is Monster Hunt. We've talked about this movie before. It cost $40 million to make. It has now grossed $380 million in that one market. The Hollywood Reporter says it's the first time in 20-plus years that a Chinese film has held the box office record for China. I don't know what the previous record holder was, but it is once again held by a Chinese film, and that is Monster Hunt. Has that opened in North America? I don't think so yet.
I don't think so. This is the one where the poster looks a lot like the poster for E.T., if you recall.
That's right. And there are some, there's lots of difficulties in doing business in China. They've been trying for 20-plus years to pass some new laws. They can't even enforce the laws that are on the books with any consistency. It's very hard to know, will your movie get approved? What do you need to do? Will it actually debut when you think it's going to debut on opening day? So it's a tricky job being, and that's why you do lots of local co-productions. And there have been some laws they've been trying to update for decades, and they still haven't done it yet, have they?
No, they haven't. And really, I think you hit the nail on the head with okay, you have trouble passing them. You have trouble enforcing them, certainly on a consistent basis. I mean, it's, basically heads I win, tails you lose. Kind of, just because you're a co-production doesn't necessarily mean you'll be considered a co-production, doesn't necessarily mean the rules are written in, they're not written. That's kind of part of the problem.
Well, so there is the film promotion laws. There's like a bundle of bills that have been languishing in China for decades now. And Variety says there's major movement on that. And it looks like they may finally get passed, which is a good sign.
Yeah, but there's going to be no change to international quotas and no movie classification system like, say, what we have here in the U.S. Basically, hey, don't bring the kids to this movie. And yes, it's okay to go see, bring the kids to the other movie. There's nothing like that in the works.
Right. And that's what international producers care about. Of course, they want more access to the Chinese market. And even local producers care about the movie classification stuff. Because right now, legally, if you release a movie in China, it should be suitable for all audiences, meaning an 8-year-old kid can go as well as a 70-year-old grandfather. Has to be good for everyone. And that's just not a great way to make art, is it?
No.
Some movies you want to make, you don't want to bring kids to. So they're hoping that that will change and that the government will allow you to release movies that are geared just towards adults. And I'm sure that will come with time.
Yeah, and some might say, hey, look, the Motion Picture Association of America, or which kind of runs the U.S.'s classification system, it doesn't necessarily write its rules down
either. It's a private industry thing. It's something that they did voluntarily to try and end the state-by-state approval that they had to get and to prevent the federal government from instituting its own system.
Right, and what some might say is, they don't necessarily write their rules down either. That's true, but at least it comes a little bit closer so that filmmakers and producers know, within a certain kind of nebulous set of features or variables, I can get a PG or PG-13 or R rating.
Right. But the point is that in the U.S., you can release a film for adults.
True.
Whatever the rating is, whether it's PG-13 or R, you can release your movie and it's not against the law. And that doesn't have to be appropriate for 5-year-old children. That's what people want in China because it's a big market. And of course, what they would like most of all is accurate box office reporting. Now, that's a problem all over the world, isn't it?
Well, it is, especially for countries where the tax issues are a big problem, where sometimes they have two registers, where you have to ring up a ticket and then you have to ring it up for the tax purposes.
I thought there was less of this because people pay with credit cards. And I think isn't it making it harder for box office to defraud either the studios or the government?
Again, the studio would then have to come in and audit at least here in North America, they'd have to audit the movie chain or the theater owner and say, we'd like to actually see all of those transactions to see what was happening. Well, in this case, we have a story here where Terminator Genisys opens versus The 100 Regiments Offensive. The 100 Regiments Offensive is a Chinese film, and there are some producers and even some moviegoers saying, hey, I went to see Terminator Genisys. My ticket said The 100 Regiments Offensive. So There's some fraud claims because The 100 Regiments Offensive is a propaganda film, effectively.
Well, it's a government-approved film, and they wanted this movie to open big on opening weekend. And they told, this is the charge by some independent producers, they told them, hey, this movie is going to make this amount of money on opening weekend. And they're like, yes, sir.
Yes.
And so they took, people bought tickets for one movie, and they handed it over to 100 Regiments Offensive. In fact, when you look at the numbers of how many theaters it was playing in, the amount of money it was making was crazy. People would be sitting on each other's laps. You know, it was virtually impossible that this movie would have generated this amount of money from the number of screenings it had, unless it was the most wildly successful film of all time. And what happened was a day later, suddenly the box office dropped again because they were back to reporting what people actually went and paid to see. It wasn't just Terminator Genisys that suffered. They maybe took profits from that movie. And other producers say they took profits from a Chinese film called Tale of Three Cities.
Yes.
This is, which I guess is an unofficial sequel to A Tale of Two Cities.
It's a
Hong Kong film written and directed by Mabel Chung, who's one of the top directors in Hong Kong. It's a film about immigration and about people who have to flee to Hong Kong and leave their son behind. So maybe that's a movie that the federal government wasn't so proud of or excited by either. So maybe that was why that was one of the other movies that got cheated out of its box office. But producers went on Twitter, didn't they? Or the Chinese equivalent, which is Weibo or Weibo.
And they said,
hey, look what's happening here. And fans would post visual images of their tickets having, you know, a ticket for
Terminator Genisys.
No, a ticket for 100 Regiments Offensive, and then scribbled on top of it by the usher is Terminator Genisys. So it was officially credited to 100 Regiments, but in fact, the usher wrote on top of it, no, go to Terminator Genisys. So right. I guess the question here is clamp down on social media.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, you know, it's one thing to do this in an age when you're, you know, all the tickets are handed out individually and there's no record of it. It's another thing to do this when somebody can take a picture and broadcast it out to 500,000 of their closest friends.
Well, you know, it's China, so there's a lot of people. One producer tweeted it out or Weibo'd it out to 8-9 million people he had following him.
Yeah. Oops.
That's a lot of people for a movie producer.
That is. I wonder who that was. But, you know, at the end of the day, and by the way, I'd like to give Patrick Von Sikofsky over my partner over there at Celluloid Junkie a plug here, because he has been doing a yeoman's job of covering the Chinese film industry, specifically in relation to box office and whether there's fraud going on. He's been saying for some time that this has been a complaint, that the numbers aren't really accurate and that there is charges of fraud. This goes way back. This is just way too obvious to ignore internationally.
And of course, it's big business. People want to make money, and the more money there is to be made, the more pressure there will be to actually have a set of ground rules and have people abide by them. You would think it might be counterintuitive. The more money to be made, the more lawlessness. But in fact, when there's a lot of money at stake, suddenly big companies are going, no.
Yeah.
Suddenly big players are in there like, oh, okay, enough of the monkey business. You know, now we're going to make sure this is done right because we have to make deals with all these other companies and we wouldn't want ourselves to get cheated. So that's what's going on in China. It's a big box office market. It's exploding. Tom Cruise has had his biggest success story with Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. It opened to number one around the world with $95 million. At number two around the world is The Visit, M. Night Shyamalan's comeback film. Yes, it's a comeback film. It made $30 million around the world on its opening weekend. It only cost $5 million to make. And really, he pulled a Mel Gibson here, didn't he? Because he self-funded his movie.
He did? I did not know that this was a movie that he paid for. I did not know that.
That's what I read. Maybe you're making me nervous now that I got this wrong, but that's what I read, that he ponied up the budget. I'm sure, you know, it's being distributed by Universal, whether they picked it up from him and played him a flat rate or whatever. I don't know, but he made it happen. That's what my understanding is. It cost $5 million to make. It grossed $30 million, and it got okay reviews, which is great for him because his last three movies or so have been pilloried as just absolute nightmares, you know, of the reviews. This one, people were like, ah, it's kind of fun. And so that's a big success story film. It was not, however, the number one film in North America. We'll get to that in a minute. And number three around the world is Minions, another $27 million. It's at $1,080 million. It squeaked past Toy Story 3 to be the number two biggest animated film of all time. So Frozen is number one. Now Minions is number two. And Toy Story 3 is at number three. That's biggest box office all time worldwide. So Minions, obviously, a massive success story. And number four around the world is Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. This is the sequel to The Maze Runner. It's a series of dystopian novels. It was a movie released around the world. It was modestly budgeted and did very well based on its budget. Now comes the new movie opening up overseas before it comes to the U.S. But wow, it's doing really well. It's tracking like 30, 40, 50, 60% better than the original in every territory. That means people saw the first movie, they want to see the sequel.
Well, and I'm trying to find any information here about...
Maybe I'm wrong about Shyamalan.
Yeah.
Well, you keep looking. The good thing about Maze Runner is they also announced that the third and final book in the trilogy would only be made into one movie, not two. So thank you, Jesus, for that. At number five around the world is The Perfect Guy. This is a thriller, and it is the number one movie in North America. It's grossed $27 million over the weekend. It opened on Friday. That's kind of unusual. Almost every movie nowadays seems to open on Thursday night. They have screenings starting around 8 o'clock. This movie actually had a cold opening on a Friday. Hasn't happened in ages. And it became the number one movie in North America. So it's got bragging rights. It passed The Visit, which was at number two here in North America. It was a really close race. But this was a movie that I kind of boasted about, didn't I? Did you see me online?
I did not see you online. No.
You didn't? Oh. Oh, my God. All my posts about this last week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox, I boldly said, look, they always underpredict these films. Perfect Guy stars Saina Lathan. It's got a lot of black actors in it. The same studio had Good Success Story. This is Screen Gems last year. And I said, they always underpredict these things. This movie looks commercial. It looks good. I think it's going to make money. And they always underreport it. The studio, the tracking was showing about 5 or 6 days before it opened that it was going to make $13 million.
Oh, yes. I did see you on
Thursday. They were like, okay, did we say 13? We mean 16 million. I'm like, no, it's going to make like 20 plus. Well, it doubled what they predicted it would make a week early. They said 13 million. It made $26 million.
And I did see you on Facebook say, yeah, I bet, or something silly like you did say that, yes.
I said, I bet it's going to make a lot more. I said, it'll make 20 million plus. I said, they're always way off on this. I only predicted they'd be 50% off. Turns out they were 100% off. They were off on The Visit as well. That did far better than they predicted as far as tracking showing. And if we say tracking is to help you adjust your marketing, you have to be able to predict it a week out, don't you?
Yeah, you should be able to figure it out.
The day before when you're up, you know, it looks more like 60 million. All right, now you're actually reacting to actual ticket sales and pre-sales and what people are doing on Thursday night or not. So, you know, if it ain't good a week out, it's not going to help you much. You can't do that much come, you know, Thursday.
Yeah, true.
Right. So tracking is still way off. I get bragging rights for The Visit and for The Perfect Guy, which did terrifically well and had a great opening weekend. And number six is a German film. It's a comedy and it's a sequel. It's called Darn You, Goethe.
Okay, well, you just like saying the name of this movie in German.
Goethe? Oh, fuck you, Goethe.
Yeah.
Well, they misspell the name of Goethe. They misspell a curse word. But basically, it's a broad comedy set in education, I guess is how to put it. It's teachers and students. And this sequel, they're headed off to Thailand. So hijinks ensue. It grossed $20 million over the weekend. It is a big sequel and had a huge success story. It's in two markets. So I guess that would be Germany and?
Maybe Switzerland?
Yeah, maybe so. So big success for that film. Good luck to them. Goethe is bigger than ever. And number seven around the world is Straight Outta Compton. Another $8 million it grossed. It's at $180 million worldwide. And the big news here is it's already made $25 million overseas.
That is news, actually.
It's in another 15 territories. I don't know what territories they are. I don't know where it has left to go. I'm guessing it won't have a big opening in Russia. I don't know. But there's no reason why they shouldn't be able to make their money back on this movie from overseas alone. It'd be great to see where it ends up, how many territories it plays. It's a massive hit here in the U.S. And, you know, it deserves to be seen. You're leaving money on the table if you don't show it in your country. And that helps pave the way for other movies like, of course, The Perfect Guy, which is only opening here in North America. We'll have to see where that goes overseas. Why leave money on the table? And number eight is Transporter Refueled. It's running out of gas. It made $8 million over the weekend. It's at $25 million and counting. Not a successful reboot for that film. You know, it cost $22 million to make. Will it end up with $66 million? I don't know. It's got a lot of territories to go. We'll have to wait and see. And number nine, basically here in North America, is War Room, that faith-based film we talked about. Another really good weekend and another great hold. It grossed $7 million over the weekend. It's at $40 million and counting. It did open up in a few other territories where it made a modest amount of money, about $1 million. But it went head-to-head here in the U.S. against 90 Minutes in Heaven. That's another faith-based film. That one stars Hayden Christensen, who is probably praying to God to help his career at this moment. War Room crushed it. 90 Minutes in Heaven only made about $2 million over the weekend. War Room, 3 or 4 weekends in, is made triple that amount. So clearly, this is a big, big hit.
Well, and A Walk in the Woods, I was surprised it continues to do well. It's, well, I'm sure they may not think it's doing well, but it It's made another $4.7 million here in the U.S. It's up to $20 million. I didn't think this film would make $5 million.
Oh, really? It's at $21 million worldwide. It costs maybe $8 million to make. So it looks like they'll be able to triple it when all is said and done. It's only playing in three territories. So yeah, that looks like it's going to be a solid success story for them. They're not going to set the world on fire. It didn't get good reviews, so it's not an Oscar hopeful. But, you know, that's where they're at. Finally, Inside Out. That's at number 10 worldwide. That passed...
Toy Story 3.
No, no, it didn't. No, it's behind Toy Story 3. It's at $750 million worldwide.
Oh, yeah,
the number three Pixar film of all time behind Toy Story 3 and Finding Nemo. I think it passed one movie in North America and another movie internationally, and is overall, I think it was Monsters University or something like that. So it's number three of all time for Pixar. So big, big success for that movie. And finally, opening up in England, it looks like, one territory is Legend. This is the Tom Hardy film where he plays both Cray brothers. Those are the gangsters in the UK. One was gay, the other was straight. They were both kind of homicidal, though. And they made $5.3 million over the weekend. All of that, presumably, in the UK.
Well, and I know you wanted to talk about, we're talking about box office figures here. You wanted to talk about advertising figures here, about some of these summer TV ad buys that iSpot TV is reporting. And now, iSpot TV kind of monitors what advertisements play and when, and they have the rate cards for these networks, so they kind of know how much it should cost if you were purchasing airtime or ad time based on the rate card. Not everybody purchases ad time based on the rate card, especially when you're buying in bulk.
Well, but, of course not. Nobody does.
Yeah, but so they have some estimates here that you wanted to mention.
Well, it's just that we never really get a good sense of their ad buys, and it's nice to have somebody give us some number that we can pretend is somewhere close to reality. Their numbers range for some big summer movies from $17 million for Paper Towns, which is the young adult film based on the John Green novel, all the way up to $44 million spent on Mad Max Fury Road. Now, it's not the total ad buy. It's just the TV ad buy, and it's just an estimate for here in North America, but it does give us a sense of the $20 to $30 million you're spending time and again for movies like Fantastic Four, Trainwreck, Tomorrowland, Avengers Age of Ultron, Jurassic Park, you name it. It's kind of interesting. Avengers, they only spent $27 million on, but Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, $42 million on. So, you know, it's like fantasy football, right? We get to take our imaginary budget number, which we only have based on whatever somebody guesses, and then we have our imaginary ad buy, and we can put it all together and come up with our imaginary profitability.
Yeah, well, and even if these numbers are off by 25%, it still kind of puts you in a ballpark where you can begin, especially if you know anything about movie marketing. You kind of know, okay, your television ad purchase of your media mix is a certain percentage. So let's call it 75%. So if you're spending $40 million in your television ad buy, you know what the rest is probably going to be.
There's a great marketing story this week, and that's about the Cray Brothers movie Legend, starring Tom Hardy. Did you see this? They had a poster extolling the movie's great reviews. 4-star review from this site, 4 stars from that site, 5 stars from that site. And smack dab in the middle of the poster is The Guardian. And you've got like Tom Hardy as the Cray Brothers, and it sort of creates a V upside down pyramid thing. And down there you have The Guardian, and it has 2 stars visible. It looks like it's one of many 4 or 5 stars reviews. But in fact, it only gave them 2 stars. So it's this visual trick where they accurately reported what The Guardian gave the movie. But the way the layout was done, you just assume, oh, The Guardian loved it, too. I thought it was just hilarious. We got a link in our show notes. You can see what the poster is. But I thought that was hilarious. Very funny.
Well, did you?
I guess you didn't.
Well, I didn't see it. So,
oh, well,
and I wish I did.
It's in our show notes. It's very funny. It was just, and the guy wrote about it, of course, the reviewer, and he laughed about it and said, well, you know, hat tip to them for that one. But it's just, it's kind of a cheeky little tweak.
Well, it's fall, Michael, as you know, and I know we're going to be talking about Broadway in a moment, but that also means that it is the autumn film festival season where all of these potential awards contenders begin to show at Venice and the Toronto Film Festival and Telluride
and the New York Film Festival and on and on and on and on, Germany and Berlin, and it never stops, does it?
No, but it starts with Venice and Telluride and Toronto, and well, the Golden Lion over in Venice was handed out.
That's right. I went to From Afar, a film from Venezuelan film, I believe, though I think its territory is Venezuela and Mexico as far as the distributors are concerned. And the head of the jury was Alfonso Cuarón, and he said, it's crazy to suggest that a Latino film won just because he was on the jury. And it's true, because there are a lot of other people on the jury. And when the festival began, the people behind the festival were touting the fact that it was a really strong year for films from the Hispanic and Latin markets. So you look at the Silver Line, that went to a film from Argentina / Spain called The Clan. And but there were other movies that were represented. Charlie Kaufman brought his stop motion film Anomalisa. Is that how you say it?
Why wouldn't Charlie Kaufman make a movie that was hard to pronounce? Of course he did.
Right. That's where he does. That's where he lives. And, Netflix had some good news from Venice. That's probably the first award that they won in any film festival, right? They won an award for Best Young Performer. It's called the Marcello Mastroianni Prize. I don't know why, because I don't think he particularly acted as a child actor. But that's the name of the prize for young performers. And it went to Abraham Atta for Beasts of No Nation, the film being released by Netflix.
That's right. And it's going to be released both in theaters and online, or streaming, I should say, at the same time, which may make it ineligible for, the Academy Awards and the SAG and the AFTERS and basically the entire awards season run. It'll be interesting to see how that's played.
Well, it's just there's rules, right? And they adjust them. It used to be you had to be on a major network, then you could be a cable show and get an Emmy.
That's right.
Now you can be online and get an Emmy. I'm sure whatever the rules are, they'll adjust them or say, I'm sorry, it's not eligible. I'm sure it'll be eligible for one or the other. I doubt that they will shoot themselves in the foot completely, that nobody can give it an award. But, it's a good product.
No, but remember that the Academy tends to lean more toward the studios and those releasing films theatrically only. At least theatrically only.
But there is
at
no
first.
Only.
not
no
anymore. not
right,
anymore.
Right. There's
not.
No only. Yeah. And of course, you have to be released in theaters first. They have lots of complicated rules about that, with exceptions for documentaries and some other short films and things like that. But yeah, there's always rules. They always got to adjust. But if you're making good movies and you're spending money on making movies, they want you to be happy and you're going to get in the club eventually.
I wonder if it's not eligible for an Academy Award, I wonder if they could try.
Well, it won't be if it's opens day and date.
Well,
right?
I wonder if they could try and get a Tony Award.
Probably not. Oh. You have to be on Broadway to win a Tony Award.
Well, if that's the case, are there any shows that are opening between now and, say, the end of the year that might be eligible?
Every show that opens between now and the end of the year will be eligible. Show opening on Broadway between now and next June will be eligible.
Okay, do you think there are any shows opening between now and the end of the year that might actually be considered for a Tony by next year, seriously?
Of course.
Okay. This is my really bad way of trying to move us into theater news.
Yes, you're coming to New York. What are you seeing?
I am seeing Hamilton, which is the reason I'm going to New York. I hope to see A Curious Incident. There's a dog. There's a nighttime. There's that whole thing. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
And then you started with a lot of Hamlet references at the top of the show. Does that mean you're going to see something rotten?
Yes, I am actually hoping to see something rotten. Maybe even The King and I, although I doubt it.
I recommend it highly.
And Beautiful, maybe. You just said Beautiful is still worth seeing.
I did not say that because I haven't seen the new cast. However, we are talking about Broadway. Why are we talking about Broadway? We talk about movies and television and music and books. And of course, Broadway is part of the entertainment, ecosystem. But most people can't get to see a Broadway show. And even if you live in New York, you can't usually afford it. That's why I
can
review
tell
them so I can get them for free.
You know what? I can tell you that, quite honestly, that whole bit about affording it is so true. After purchasing a ticket for Hamilton and on some of these other shows, I'm like, who do they think is seeing these shows? I mean, it takes all year to save up for this.
Yeah, so we try to keep our eye on all these areas of entertainment. We don't want to go too long without talking about books or TV or music. So why are we talking about theater? If people aren't living in New York, why do they care?
Well, these days, it's because, let's face it, first of all the movie studios are there looking to pick up properties, okay? A. B, very often, these shows will travel. And they will travel not only nationally here in North America, but they'll travel overseas in Europe and to Australia.
They go to Japan. They go to England. They go everywhere.
Especially the musicals, because they travel a bit better. And some of these plays will be up for Pulitzers and for Nobel. I don't know about Nobel Prizes. They win other awards in other countries.
That's true. Not that we care so much about awards. But yeah, it's all part of the same system. Books become movies. Movies become TV shows. TV shows become plays. Plays become musicals. Musicals become movies. So it's all, I always feel like it's good to know a lot about all these different areas because they all feed into each other. You know, if you're reading a book, chances are it's good and it's a success. It's going to see some future life. There are shows on Broadway that are not going to see future life, however, because they're closing. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. It won the Tony for Best Musical. It finally announced its closing in January, just shy of 1,000 performances. It's really hard to stay on Broadway for 2.5 years. Only 100 plus shows have done it in history. So no shame for Gentleman's Guide, but it did get awfully close. It ran for 2 years. It built its audience very slowly. And the Tony Award definitely put it over the top and helped it become a commercial success. That show is closing. And of course, it's touring. I don't know. It may have even opened in London. Yeah, I don't know. But also closing is Mamma Mia. That was announced a while ago. And of course, that's one of the biggest hits of all time.
And now they're actually working on an adaptation of
I'm making a new movie.
Well, yes, but they're working on a musical adaptation of the movie adaptation of the musical Mamma Mia. So it will be the musical based.
They're making Mamma Mia.
Oh,
God. Oh, God.
Yeah,
sorry.
I'm kidding.
Working on a movie, a sequel to Mamma Mia.
Yes.
The film was a big success. They're looking to make a sequel. Also closing is Hedwig and the Angry Inch. We covered that. And finally, On the Town, which really kicked it up with Misty Copeland. Oh, my God. People flocked to see her. They don't go to the New York Ballet to see her. That show became a massive success for about 10 performances. So they probably wish they had Misty Copeland from day one. And Hand to God is closing. This is a show about a puppet that's possessed by Satan. It must close January 3rd. I'm putting that in quotes because it has been the lowest grossing show on Broadway since the day it opened. And it's transferring to London's West End. I don't know who's paying for that. But why they think they want to rush to the West End with this, I'm not quite sure. I like the show a lot. I thought the lead actor was great. But it's not been a commercial success. And I'm not quite sure how they're justifying this transfer. But more power to them. It's inexpensive to run, I'm sure. But at $250,000 a week in grossing, I'm not sure they made any money. They certainly did not announce that they had recouped their investment.
Well, I'll tell you, the lead actor there is expensive because he wants to be paid not only for himself, but also for the sock puppet.
That's right. And of course, these shows have announced closing, but there are others that look like they might not be here for long.
Well, and you list a whole bunch of shows here. I don't know if we want to go over all of them.
It's three.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, Chicago, pretty remarkable that it's still. Jersey Boys, I had no idea that it was still playing on Broadway.
Oh, yeah. And the original lead actor had come back like a year ago, and that helped boost it up again. So it's been doing great. It is a strong show. And Chicago, of course, has run both of these shows are legendary hits. I mean, they're, you know, once in a lifetime hits. But Chicago has grossed 18 out of the last 36 weeks. That's how long this year has been going on. It's grossed less than 600,000. It's a pretty good safe bet that it costs at least 600,000 a week to run at this stage, even though it's not a elaborate show. It's pretty bare bones in a way. That's its aesthetic still. And seven of those weeks, it grossed less than $500,000, $500,000. So I'm assuming every other week it lost money, you know?
Yeah.
So why would it keep running? You know, if it's not making lots of money, why wouldn't you just close it? Because you're keeping the lights on. You're paying off producers, and you know when it breaks even, that means the producers got paid, the composers got paid, the actors and the house and the musicians and the playwright and stagehands, everybody made money that week. It doesn't mean it didn't make money. It just means it didn't put more into the till, you know, beyond what everybody got paid.
Plus, so you then get to say to the touring show, look, it was on Broadway for X number of performances
of
years.
At this point for Chicago, that's a moot issue. It's one of the longest running hits in history. So it's the most successful revival of all time. It's one of the top five, I think, shows of all time, if not certainly top 10, but I think it's top five. So that's not an issue anymore. But yeah, when you think, oh, it's just about breaking even for the year. Yeah, another year where everybody got money. That's why shows like these will run a long time, because once you're at a certain stage, even if you're on the bubble, as long as everybody's getting paid, everybody's happy.
Well, maybe they're also just waiting to see like how many of those people who are going to see Mamma Mia show up for Jersey Boys or Chicago.
Absolutely. When shows close, that means the tourists who want to go to those name brand shows, they've never been to Broadway, they want to see something they've heard about for years. Oh, Chicago, Jersey Boys, it's a safe bet.
Shows are showing long-term weaknesses. Something rotten is in that.
Well, we're looking at new shows here to say who's going to be a long runner. And we know that Hamilton is going to be on the boards. They will hit 1,000 performances. There's literally no question about it. And to say that is to say how much of a big hit it is, because you can't normally say that. But Hamilton will be on the boards 2.5 years from now. That's amazing. That means it's one of the biggest hits of all time. So a show not making it 2.5 years is not a sign it's a flop, not by any stretch of the imagination. But if you're saying who's really got in them to get legs to get past a year, 1.5 years, 2, well, we're looking at Fun Home and Finding Netherland and Something Rotten. And yes, The King and I. And all these shows have a certain weakness to them. Something Rotten is like a third empty every week. It's in a big house, isn't it? But and it's making good money. It made $900,000 last week. I'm sure they made a profit.
I can tell you why they made $900,000 trying to buy a ticket to that thing.
That's right. But they're only making 60% of their potential gross. And it's very early in the run. You know, it just opened up a few months ago, which means to me that for the first 3 or 6 months, you've got hardcore theater goers. You've got everybody who lives in New York, people who really go to the theater a lot. They have seen this show if they want to see it. Now, after 3 to 6 months, then you're dealing with the tourists. You got to have good word of mouth. You got to have people in the heartland who just are coming to Broadway, and they've got to have that name recognition or be willing to be convinced that they want to see a show. And long term, it doesn't look like they're going to get there. They'll make their money back. It will do well in touring, perhaps. It may even play better in London than it does here because it's all about Shakespeare.
Yeah, but I was going to say that Shakespeare, he just doesn't draw anymore, does he?
That's right. But that show long term, I'm a little iffy about. Same thing for Finding Neverland. That's been a big success from the get-go. It has been grossing over $1 million for a long time, but it's getting a little softer. But again,
does it still have all of its Kelsey Grammer and everybody in it?
He was in and out, and he's come back in again, I believe, by now for the fall. But Mamma Mia closes. That means suddenly there's $800,000 a week in ticket sales that have to go somewhere else. And Finding Neverland is based on Peter Pan, Something Rotten they heard good things about. That's when those shows can pick up an audience and build towards the future. Another one I'm worried about is Fun Home.
This is the one that won the Tony Award, right, for Best Musical? Right.
You could not ask for a better success story. I'm sure it doesn't cost a lot to run because it's a small cast and a small pit, meaning the orchestra isn't very big. It's never going to have huge grosses because it's in one of the smallest houses on Broadway. But if you look at the box office chart, it went straight up. It sort of built very small, started very small, went all the way up to a peak right around the Tony Awards where it made $800,000. And then now it's starting to go right back down again.
Is it worth seeing? I mean, like, is this?
I'm one of the few people who didn't love it. You know, okay. And I don't like it. I like it even less on Broadway than it did at the Public. I am absolutely in the minority. If any of you had any interest in seeing it, I would not dissuade you. I wouldn't say, no, don't go. Absolutely not. It's well worth seeing, especially if you're a theater buff. Everybody else loved it. It's going to make money.
And it still has the original cast?
It still has the original cast. And it's going to be profitable for everyone involved. And they can pat themselves on the back on a huge success story. But I don't know that it's going to be there a year from now. At the box office, I don't think it's going to be there. And the one that really surprised me is The King and I.
Yeah.
This is a name brand show. It's Rodgers and Hammerstein. It has Kelly O'Hara in the lead. She finally won the Tony for Best Actress. But it's never really caught on fire. At this stage, it should be sold out. And it's not sold out. And that makes me think, it's going to have a good, healthy run. They'll make money. But I don't think it's not going to have the run that South Pacific did. So, the fact is King and I is a weaker show.
Yes, that
is
very true.
So, it's just, unless you rewrote the book to make that stronger and less, frankly, silly, this is as good a production as that musical is going to get. I really believe that. It's gorgeous looking. She's great. The male lead at the time, Ken Watanabe, was great. I don't know who the lead guy is now, but I'm sure he's good too.
I tell you, but I can't pronounce his name. I can't pronounce the last name, so...
All right, well, you're racist. And,
oh my God, no, I'm just not very good at last names.
So, this is, again, they will make money, but it's not going to be the runaway hit that their last show was, which was the South Pacific.
Well, we have some shows coming up. School of Rock, Andrew Lloyd Webber will be rocking it with the School of Rock.
Well, exactly, and that's why I'm a little suspicious of that one. Because he started, that was the whole idea. He and Tim Rice, we're rock and roll guys, come to theater. It's like, yeah, but you listen to Jesus Christ Superstar and all the, it's not really rock and roll.
What about
he's really not rock and roll. So I'm just not convinced he's going to rock out, but who knows? He's Glenn Slater, who did Spring Awakening with him on it. So maybe it'll work.
What about the Gin Game? James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson. She was great in Trip to Bountiful.
Did you see it?
Yes, I did.
Oh, well, this is money in the bank. This is a limited run with two big stars. They are legends. It's a crowd-pleasing show. It's very inexpensive to mount. Whoever invests in it will make their money back. They will make a lot of money because they're not going to stay in it forever. They're of a certain age. It's going to have a limited engagement. Then they'll leave. It's possible they could put two new people into it. That could certainly work. They've done it before. Maybe they'll try to make the Gin Game have a long run by bringing in two other big names once James Earl Jones and Cicely Tyson are ready to move on. But the fact is, until they're ready to move on, they'll probably do just fine.
Well, here's a show that's opening in the spring, another one that I'm about to mention. I wonder if when it opens in the spring, they'll have to give the front rows raincoats or something because from all the blood that's going to spill off the stage. And I'm talking about American Psycho.
That's right. American Psycho is coming in the spring. It played in London and it got a lot of great reviews, but it was not a huge success commercially. So but they got great reviews and they're convinced it'll work on Broadway, maybe even better there. I'm very eager to see it. It's Duncan Sheik worked on the music. I love Duncan Sheik. I think he's a real talent and I'm intrigued by it. So we'll have to see where it ends. It stars Benjamin Walker, who of course was starred in Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. That was another acclaimed show. They tried to jump to Broadway and it didn't do well, but he got a lot of great acclaim for his performance. So we'll have to see where it ends up. It looks like a good spring. You've got a revival of She Loves Me. You've got this great new musical called Shuffle Along and a lot of big star revivals like The Gin Game. These are shows that have limited runs, but they're not going to make a lot of money because they're only going to run for 18 weeks or 14 weeks or 19 weeks or whatever it is. But with big stars in it, they're going to make their money back. And if they're really good, they, of course, get to win a Tony. And that's Long Day's Journey Into Night, A View from the Bridge, and especially The Crucible, with great casting and a great team, including Sophie Okonedo, Ben Whishaw, who's great in London right now, Ciarán Hinds, and a score by Philip Glass. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
Well, but winning a Tony really is kind of a big deal for at least the investors in these types of adventures.
It is. You've got 20, 30, 40 people, and now they're limiting who gets to get a Tony. And they're also saying you got to pay for your statue because we're tired of printing up 40 statues because they've got so many investors. So you got to make sure you're on that list of line of producers who actually get to get the Tony. You get to go on stage. It's very exciting for you since you're not going to make a lot of money in that revival Long Day's Journey. At least it's a big deal for Tony night.
Oh, well, if that's a big deal, then maybe it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the bookstore chain Barnes & Noble is doing great, at least in non-reading sort of stuff. Sales in the first quarter were up 17%, at least in categories like toys and games. Books? Not so much. Sales were down compared to the first quarter of last year. The college stores were spun off. And the Nook division is turning into, a rounding error, with hardware and ebook sales totaling $54 million for the quarter and falling, compared to $940 million for the retailer. Nook is expected to keep falling. And by the way, Michael, if it does fall and drops on the ground, I hear they break. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, because this is the number one physical retail store in North America for books. It's the biggest chain. It's the biggest presence all around the country. You can go and find a Barnes & Noble. And they're not doing great at all. And the only reason they're doing decently, the only reason same door sales are basically the same as they were last year, up like up 1%, is because they're not selling books. They're selling toys. They're selling games. They're selling stationery. Their attempt to do Nook collapsed. And their big push is where we're going to have omni-channel approach to selling. I don't know what that... I tried to figure out what they were talking about. It's like, it's going to be a great selling experience, whether you're in the store or online. I couldn't figure out what the hell.
Somebody went to a retail conference and learned a few buzzwords.
Some gobbledygook. I could not figure out what exactly they meant by it. It sounds like nonsense. And I'm worried because you want bookstores to have a physical presence because then people can walk in the door and find out what books are available.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble's, to me, has become the store you go to when your kid has a birthday party and you haven't purchased a present. You go there. Oh, look, instant present.
Absolutely.
If you want to run a nonprofit, you probably don't need to run Barnes & Nobles, but you do actually need, apparently, some profits, actually. First, Sesame Street, or Sesame Workshop, or is it Children's Workshop?
Now it's called Sesame Workshop.
Oh my gosh, I had no idea. Well, they saw a changing landscape and did a major deal with HBO. National Geographic saw an opportunity to improve its endowment and get financially bigger than ever, so they've launched a new partnership with 21st Century Fox. Fox is ponying up $725 million, and National Geographic says it will now have a $1 billion endowment and immediately double its science, research, and education funding. Fox gets 73% of the new company, but they have equal representation on the board. The company will include the worldwide TV channels they've been working on together over the past 18 years, as well as the iconic National Geographic magazine and more. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because we've just presented the story as politely and positively as possible. The fact is they sold off the magazine and they sold off the thing and Fox owns it now.
Pretty much.
I mean, that's what they did. They're like, we're going into a new investment. We've been working with them for 20 years, so it's not that big a change, except now they're in charge.
Yeah.
You know, they own 75% of the company.
Yeah.
Well, goodbye, National. I mean, that magazine is iconic as it gets. And to be bought up, you know, it's one of the last great institutions, and now it's owned by another multinational. So, you know, it's the big end of an era.
Yes. Well, and I think 21st Century Fox, News Corp, whatever you want to call it, they are not known for a hands-off approach. So
now, most multinationals are not known for a hands-off approach.
It's true.
It's not like Disney is known for, do what you want. Have fun. Here's $1 billion.
Maybe Adele is busy with her long-awaited new album.
No pressure.
It was believed the Oscar-winning singer would pen the theme song for the new James Bond film Spectre, but instead, it's now going to be fellow Brit Sam Smith, the first UK male artist to sing 007's main theme since Paul McCartney back in the 1970s with Live and Let Die. Duran Duran, by the way, also did the honors as a group, becoming the first to hit number one in the US with a James Bond theme. And do you know what, Michael?
What?
Okay, before we get sued, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, could you not have at least cut to the painful chorus? It's a view to a kill. And it's the most awkward song title, and yet that went to number one. That's how big Duran Duran was at the time. And by the way, they have a new album out.
Yes.
This is a big deal. Why? It's not a big deal. You name another star singing a Bond theme. It was Jack White, and was it Alicia Keys, and, you know, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden before that. Now we got Sam Smith. He's gay. James Bond is the most heterosexual movie franchise in the history of the world. Actually, that's not true.
Indiana Jones.
That's kind of not true because it's kind of campy too in a way. But seriously, this is a, you know, nobody even mentioned it barely. The fact that you were having a gay man singing the theme song for James Bond. No jokes. I didn't see any jokes about, oh, he'll probably be singing a song to Bond. You know, I like you. You know, nothing. People are like, oh yeah, of course. So that's really a kind of a big step. The fact that they did it. And that people, I mean, some people mentioned the fact that he was gay, but basically they didn't make a big deal about it. No silly jokes. Maybe late night television. I didn't hear them. So that's a sign of changing times.
Well, isn't that a good thing?
Of course.
Well, let me ask you about this next story. We'll find out if this next story is a good thing, because right now Sam Smith performs live and in person, right? I mean, you could go see him. Yeah. But maybe 100 years from now, fans will pay to see a hologram of Smith performing his Bond theme song. Sounds crazy, right?
Yes.
Well, hardly. Billie Holiday is coming to the Apollo in New York City, in fact. She sang there dozens of times, and now a hologram of Holiday will become a permanent attraction, apparently becoming part of the tour as fans checking out the venue can watch Holiday dig into a song or two. And she's not the only dead celeb coming back. Whitney Houston will go on a new world tour in hologram form alongside a live band. Could you imagine, like, being in that band? You got to think, oh my God, I've hit rock bottom. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? I mean, ignoring all the behind the scenes fracas between the various hologram companies and who owns what, because that's an issue here that we're not going to get into today. We've talked about it before. We've had other tours. We've had Sinatra touring in hologram form. We've had Elvis touring. We've had other shows use holograms briefly, you know, to bring back Tupac Shakur and so on. We've had legal issues where a rapper was banned from appearing in a city, and they tried to even ban his hologram from appearing and performing in a city. So this isn't going away. To me, it sounds silly, of course, and stupid. Like you said, one guy wants to pay to see a hologram. You know, it's so dumb, right? I'd rather see footage of the actual Whitney Houston singing back in the day. But it ain't going anywhere. And at some point, someone's going to do it well, and they're going to make money from it. At some point, it's probably going to be interesting. You know, you go to the Apollo, and there's Billie Holiday singing, you know, Strange Fruit on the stage. I guess it could have a weird, eerie, ghost-like feel to it. And, you know, it ain't going anywhere. Something looked like a gimmick to me, just like, you know, 3D, clearly is here to stay.
Well, and, you know, at some point, if it does catch on, there will be people who actually...
It's caught.
Well, there will be performers who actually do their own hologram performances, where they do all of the
tech
work
up
front.
Yeah. Yeah.
King Kong, by the way, is back, much like Billie Holiday. After Peter Jackson failed to reignite Kong fever, they're at it again. Kong Skull Island has been brewing for a while, and now it's jumping from Universal to Warner Brothers. Why? So they can do crossovers with Godzilla and create yet another movie universe. Huzzah! Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. I mean, why don't you try to make a successful movie first?
Yeah.
Godzilla hasn't torn it up. King Kong hasn't torn it up. Why are you suddenly... I mean, back in the 70s, they had a decent hit. That was the last time Kong was a hit. So why are you suddenly planning a 8-film multi-crossover Kong-Godzilla world? It's exhausting. You know, make a good movie. Then we can talk.
Well, I would argue, and I'm sure there are others that would argue, that both Kong and Godzilla tore it up. They tore up Tokyo in fact.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. Now, Stephen Colbert debuted in Late Night with the most attention since the glory days of Leno and Letterman. It's no surprise since he's arguably been the biggest creative force in Late Night for most of the past decade. But now, he's a talk show host. The opening night was big, but not necessarily historic, at least in the ratings. And the ratings soon, by the way, fell back down, with Fallon almost immediately winning in key younger demos. And Fallon scored Donald Trump, getting his biggest ratings in a year and a half. In short, Late Night is very competitive with Fallon and Kimmel and now Colbert. They're not close to Letterman and Leno, at least not close to their ratings numbers were 20 years ago. And those numbers 20 years ago, they weren't even close to what Johnny Carson had. Is Colbert not dominating out of the box a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm going to say it's a big deal.
Oh, you see, I wouldn't necessarily.
I know, but you know, Letterman switched over from NBC to CBS and he led for a year. You know, he, with momentum and excitement and all that, he beat Leno for a year before Leno crawled his way back. Stephen Colbert had the biggest, best chance to establish himself as the man. You know, like you would think with all the attention he had, he should have at least dominated for a few months, a few weeks, and then come back to Earth. But he came back to Earth immediately. And frankly, the show wasn't very good. And every review would tell you, you can't judge the show on the first night. Got to give it a couple weeks, couple months. But he's been doing a late night show for, you know, 10 years. I know it was a sketch show, but he was interviewing guests for 10 years in character, I grant you. But I frankly found his interviewing was pretty weak.
Yeah,
you know, he said, I had 9 months to prepare. I can do this every time. Actually, the first show, not so good.
Well, he said he could do it for the rest of his life, provided that he had 9 months to prepare for 1 hour of television.
Right. But he had 9 months to prepare, and it wasn't that good.
Yeah, I always find those jitters, blah, blah, blah.
I'll check in 3 months and 6 months. But I'm going to put a little more weight behind the fact that he did a bad job interviewing. It wasn't very funny. And that his ratings fell back so immediately that I'm feeling like, wow, you know, all the attention and hype was perhaps not backed up by the actual show.
Now, the Force will be strong when the Star Wars... Now, the Force, it's going to be strong when the new Star Wars opens in North America on December 18th. We all know that, right?
Yes. I can't wait. I'm going to be in line.
Well, if you just can't wait, you can fly to London or Moscow and see it on December 17th.
What?
Yeah. Or Michael, and this is if you really can't wait. Okay. I'm going to give you a heads up here. You can head to Paris or Copenhagen on December 16th. You can see it there.
Really?
Yeah.
Two days in advance. Okay.
Yeah. If you really can't wait. And you really want to annoy Michael, by the way, in the bargain, you can head to the United Arab Emirates and see it at the first commercial screening on December 15th. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? We have worldwide openings all the time, and it does not always make sense to have it day and date. So a few days here and there is what happens. I'm not quite sure why this staggered release date over 3 days. It seems like a little bit of is it a good decision? I don't know. I mean, I can see adjusting a couple weeks or whatever, but, you know, these 3 days, why not just have it everywhere at the same time to have a worldwide event? But what I don't understand is why it's opening in the UAE first. What possible? That's such a tiny market. Why would that be the place where you would debut Star Wars around the world? Why would that be the first commercial ticket you sell be the UAE? What holiday is it that you that tiny market? You say, yeah, we'll let you have it first. So the reviews and the text and the tweeting and stuff is going to come not from England, not from the U.S., not from, you know, it's going to come from the UAE. That's bizarre.
Yeah, I don't understand it. There must be some kind of promotion going on or some. I don't know.
Somebody said, we'll give you a couple million dollars if you let us play it in our country first.
Yeah, there's got to be a tie-in.
Is it a bribe? I mean, the UAE for me is the equivalent of South Africa during apartheid. I think it's ridiculous. So, you don't go holiday in there. You don't go. And to let them be the first people in the world to have Star Wars is kind of offensive.
Well, speaking of Star Wars, they're not getting Star Wars land. Remember, we talked about that a couple weeks ago. Disney announcing, hey, we're going to build these 14-acre lands in all their parks. They're going to break ground on that in 2016.
They announced a groundbreaking date or something?
Yes. At first, I thought, oh, they're going to be ready by 2016. No, they're going to, start.
All right.
Now, kids. Don't read this book. Whatever you do, do not read the New Zealand coming-of-age novel Into the River. Yes, it won all the major awards, which would normally be a good reason for teenagers to run the other way, but it also has cursing and drinking and quote-unquote intimacy, which I'm sure pretty much means sex or close enough. So stay away. Into the River by Ted Daw is what we're talking about. It's dangerous. Now, how well do you think that works, Michael?
Not well at all.
Yeah, in fact, this young adult novel was initially self-published before being picked up by a publisher, which is when it received critical praise. It was initially rated M and unrestricted. Then it was reclassified as only appropriate for kids 14 and older. That was appealed by teachers who wanted to use it in classrooms, but Christian groups spoke up, and now it's been banned entirely. Even adults can't pass it around in New Zealand. It's not illegal to own your own copy, per se, but you can't give it to anyone, even another adult. Now, this ruling will be reviewed again in a few months. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, and of course it just brings attention to Into the River by Ted Dahl. But it's bizarre to have a book banned in a country, you know, like New Zealand, a democracy. Like, you're an adult, you can't, this book is so frightening that you can't have an adult read it, and it really confuses what a young adult novel is. Like, a young adult means just for kids. No, it doesn't. So it's really, really bizarre and sad.
And it kind of makes the whole country look a little backward.
Exactly. It makes them look stupid. I'm sure people are angry about it and they're going to speak up and, you know, have things change, because it hasn't happened in decades, but it's a little embarrassing, and it should be embarrassing, and hopefully they'll step forward and make changes. But if you're here in America or you're somewhere else in the world and you want a book about teenagers that includes cursing and drinking and gambling and intimacy and even more cursing, not to mention rugby, I recommend Standoff by Andrew Smith. Great book. Just came out. It's the sequel to Winger. I liked it a lot.
Well, speaking of being banned, do you want to play China? If so, don't hang out with the Dalai Lama. That's the implicit message from Chinese authorities. Pop band Maroon 5 was going to play in China this July, but that was abruptly canceled, and many believe it happened after the band's keyboardist wished the Dalai Lama a happy birthday on Twitter. Now rockers Bon Jovi met the same fate. They were going to hit several cities in China, but apparently Chinese authorities realized the band had once included a brief image of the spiritual leader in a background video playing during one of their shows. Now I'm guessing, I'm going to go out on a limb here, that U2 playing China is completely out of the question. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, not to mention the Beastie Boys. Not that they're of course gone forever. Of course, the other two guys will never tour as the Beastie Boys again, but you know what I mean. This is a big deal. This is just a great way to remind yourself, you know what? China's a huge market. It can't be ignored. It's not a tiny country like the UAE. There are, of course, abuses in many countries around the world, including the US, that people don't like or want to question, or what about this law? What about that? But it's a big market. You're going to have to deal with them, but it ain't easy. There's lots of things going on. You can't think, oh, I make a movie there, a co-production, I'm going to get all my money back. Nope. So, you just got to keep that in mind. This is not straightforward. There's a lot of complicated issues to keep uppermost in your head when you're going to get in bed with a totalitarian government.
So Donald Trump, he's running for president, right?
And is he?
Yeah, that's created headaches for some of the companies he owns or is in business with. After Trump pandered to bigots with hateful stereotypes about Mexicans, Latino channels dumped the pageants Trump owns via his Miss Universe company. Then NBC, by the way, they dumped them too. Then Trump, he sued everyone. Then he bought out NBC so he would own the pageants outright. And now the media agency, WME-IMG, which is, I think, a part of the William Morris Endeavor Agency, they have bought out Trump for an undisclosed price. This adds the Miss Universe, Miss USA, and Miss Teen USA events to a portfolio that includes fashion weeks in cities around the world. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal, because now we can set aside Trump and just get back to the fact that these events are sexist.
Yeah, pretty much.
But there was more Trump news about Arnold Schwarzenegger, wasn't there? I knew you'd be excited to say it because it gets you a chance to do Arnold Schwarzenegger.
What do you mean? It's not a tumor.
He's the new host of Celebrity Apprentice. The former governor of California is replacing presidential candidate Donald Trump in a TV reality show, Celebrity Apprentice. Welcome to America.
You're fired.
Keep going.
It's an amazing story. Director Sidney Pollack filmed. Are you serious? Unbelievable. We talked about this last week. Director Sidney Pollack filming Aretha Franklin when she was performing a legendary gospel concert, creating the best-selling album of her career. Pity, by the way, that he forgot to sync the sound. After 40 years, however, they finally cleared the technical hurdles and were able to sync the sound, but producers couldn't come to terms with Franklin or untangle the rights. So they sold it off. The new owner insisted he found the original contract with Franklin signing off on the project in, ironically, his own handwriting. So he planned a screening. He did it, to Telluride, right?
That's right.
A judge disagreed and stopped the premiere of that screening, but that has never stopped a producer. They arranged private screenings, insisting the legal issue with Franklin would soon be resolved and a bidding war commenced. But as soon as the trades reported on the secret screening...
While it was happening,
she filed a new injunction saying, no screenings to sell the movie you don't have the rights to. Thank you very much. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big whoop, but what are they? Are they out of their minds? I mean, why can't they make a deal with her? What is she asking for? And why did they think it would be okay to just go ahead and hold screenings and hope she would notice?
I don't know.
It was just way to piss her off even more. You know, it's just a cluster. It's a mess. It's a big fat mess. And I can't wait to see the movie.
Okay, well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I can tell you how this story will affect you. It will make your wallet a lot less heavy. I can tell you that much. Your wallet will no longer have all that heft of actually having cash or money.
People always know that Apple releases new products in the fall. They announced a new Apple phone. Do we call them iPhones still, or we call them Apple phones now?
It's iPhone. I don't know why they got rid of the eyes, but...
They've got the Apple Watch. Now everybody says Apple instead of I. So they're saying Apple, Apple, Apple. It's good. They finally created a stylus, which they call the Apple Pencil, not the I Pencil. So they're, you know, getting people to repeat that incredibly valuable brand name of Apple.
Well, but that said, I remember Steve Jobs saying, you know, who needs a stylus? I have the best stylus in the world. It's called my finger.
That's right. And they said, yeah, you know what? Times change. We don't need a tablet. Yes, we do. We don't need a big fat phone. Yes, we do. We don't need a stylus. Yes, we do.
We don't need a keyboard. Well, apparently you do.
Right. So it's, you know, is it desperation? I don't think so. What happens every year is they announce a new iPhone and people go, yeah, whatever. It's just, you know, a little bit better than the last one. It's boring. And it goes on to sell massive numbers.
Well, right? Because they're actually good devices.
They're predicting they're going to have a first weekend record for sales, that the advance orders are outpacing the last version and look like they're going to hit more than 10 million units sold first weekend and set yet another record. But investors really shrugged, didn't they? Because every time before Apple had their announcement, the buildup to that would raise the Apple stock. It might fall sometimes after the announcement if people were nonplussed by what they announced, but it always rose in the few weeks leading up to it. This year, for the first time, it didn't rise.
Well, I mean, that said, look at what was going on in the stock market during the run-up to this announcement. So you can't really fault... the market was going crazy.
But the whole thing was it was a fake event. What happened was people were, you know, planning to make money off saying, aha, Apple's going to make an announcement and then their stock's going to rise. So they were buying stock in advance, anticipating this artificial bump that they could predict with regularity. And guess what? That never works forever. You can't say, oh, every fall at this time for 3 weeks, the stock will guarantee rise. And that's what they were doing. And so they got screwed.
Well, you know, it's buy on the rumor, sell on the news, right? So,
that's what they were doing. But it's not a rumor that they're having a new announcement. That was the problem. They were taking this annual event as some sort of guaranteed cash money cow. You know, they're going to make an announcement. I can buy stock 4 weeks before, then sell it, you know, the day of and make money.
Well, and you might be wondering, why are these guys covering a consumer electronics announcement? And really what I would say is, yes, it's consumer electronics, no doubt about it. But I would also say it's consumer consumption, okay? This is how media is being consumed these days. More than 50% of all website visits are on mobile devices. And when I go to my kids' soccer games and there are toddlers around to keep them quiet during the games, guess what? Parents are giving their kids these iPhones or these smartphones or these iPads, and they're all running off and they're watching YouTube videos, mostly cartoons. But still, you know, this is how media is being consumed on these devices. And in fact, Apple's no dummy. They figured that out too. And the long-rumored update to the Apple TV was announced during the whole... what did you think of that whole Apple TV thing with the remote control where you can swipe back and forth?
We previewed it last week and we got it pretty on the board that they were going to... not go crazy about gaming, but that was, you know, gaming was barely mentioned. It was mentioned broadly, but they didn't go crazy about it. But Apple TV and gaming is a big part of their future. They know that people play games on the iPhone and they want to make a more friendly environment for gamers. So their remote can double as a gaming device, as a gaming remote. And they also talked about opening their Apple TV platform to third-party developers. How is this different from the App Store the way it was in the past? I'm not quite clear, but I know that it was a significant change.
Well, right now, what the App Store is for building application software for both the iPhone and the iPad. So for iOS, okay? Oh. There are no Apple TV apps, so to speak, that aren't made or developed directly with Apple. So HBO goes to Apple and says, we're going to, you know, work together. And
so now they've changed that. Now it's opened up to say, hey, you want to create an app for our Apple TV? Knock yourself out.
Hey, you want to create a video game that's just for Apple TV? No problem. That's basically
You can create it for anyone, but it will work on the Apple TV. You know, now you can make it work for the Apple TV universe.
Correct. And that's cool. What this is about.
And so that's a big change.
Yeah. And also, I think Apple is saying, you know what? We held off on announcing the Apple TV for at least 3 to 6 months while we waited for all of your little cable bundle deals to
Clearly, we have to wait longer.
Right. And you know what? We're not going to hold off anymore. We're going to announce it. And instead of working with you, what we're going to do is we're just going to create all these little apps that are over the top. And instead of you getting your retransmission fees, which you could have gotten from us if you had lowered your prices a little bit, now we're just going to, you know, you make an app, you put it on our Apple TV, people can subscribe or they can watch the content. But, it's what that does is it kills the cable bundle and it kills the cash cow that is the cable bundle, frankly.
So for Apple or for other people?
For other people, for all the networks.
Oh, so you're thinking that they won't have bundled, won't they offer that as an option in 2016? I thought this was just the precursor to having bundled TV
channels.
Well,
they might. They very well might.
But now they've got a workaround.
Yeah, because now they can basically go to the History Channel or the National Geographic Channel and say, all right, you wouldn't give us retransmission rights for a slim bundle. But if you want to create an app that you can put on the Apple TV, go right ahead. Please do so. By the way, if people subscribe to that app through Apple TV, we get 30%. I'm sure that will be a part of it. By the way, every person that subscribes to the History Channel or National Geographic or any one of these apps is probably one less person subscribing to cable where you actually get paid.
So HBO, you don't think got a special deal? You think they get 30% of every subscriber?
No. I think HBO got a special deal without a doubt.
All right.
But so, that's really the news from Apple. I mean, it was a 2.5-hour event.
They finally hit their head against the wall and gave up in trying to do bundling TV.
Yeah, or unbundling TV, yeah.
Right. But yeah. Now in 2016, when they announce a bundled TV option, won't we look silly?
No. I think at some point they will definitely announce these slimmer bundles because eventually people will want to do business with Apple. It's just that they were hoping to break Apple. Apple said, yeah, forget it. We're not gonna deal with this. We're just going to announce the product. And you know what?
Will you buy the iPad mini upgrade, which they barely mentioned, or the iPad Pro, which is a bigger tablet? Will you buy the Apple Pencil? Will you buy Apple TV? Will you buy an Apple Watch? What are you buying?
I'm not buying an Apple Watch. Far as the iPad mini, I just got an iPad last year.
You're fine.
Yeah. And quite honestly, I'm not buying the Apple Pencil unless it's going to do my Apple homework or come with an Apple eraser. Okay. For $99, that is a very expensive pencil.
All right.
Unless I can sharpen it, I ain't buying it.
All right.
Okay. Well, that wraps up. Well, I almost said Big Dealer, Big Whoop, but that wraps up Inside Baseball for this week and moves us along into obituaries, where we will be talking about a couple people here, including Martin Milner, who passed away at the age of 83. If you don't know who he is the star of Route 66 and Adam 12. So
I mean, that just shows you the power of TV. You know, this guy, not a great actor. He'd be the first person to say it, but he was around for decades and you just recognize him as soon as you see him. And he dies and it makes the papers because everybody remembers, you know, that those shows of people of a certain era. They're like, oh, him, you know, it's just so they become part of your life when they're in your TV on your screen for a decade like he was.
Yeah. And back then, I mean, it was, you know, millions of people.
Oh, absolutely. A lot more people watching. There were a lot fewer people in the country. Also dying this week was Frank D. Gilroy, a playwright. He had a long, successful career in theater, film and TV. He wrote books. He did everything from writing episodes of The Rifleman to screenplays, adapting his own plays. But his big success, his big claim to fame will always be the Tony and Pulitzer Prize winning play. The subject was Roses, about the tangled love between a son and his parents. It's one of the first shows I saw when I came to New York. It was a revival starring Patrick Dempsey. It was a pretty good revival. Pretty good play. But my God, you know, that was the big success story for Frank D. Gilroy. That was in 1964. But he'd have a late career resurgence, and that was The Gig, which is this little film that he wrote the screenplay for, sort of a jazz film about musicians getting together for a gig. And that was turned into a theater piece, which is one reason we talk about theater. Every movie becomes a play, every play becomes a movie, and it never ends.
Well, and he had several children, two of whom you probably know, Dan Gilroy. He directed Nightcrawler, is married to Renee Russo. He's, in fact, he's writing Kong Skull Island. And Tony Gilroy, he wrote, he's a really well-known screenwriter. He wrote everything from Devil's Advocate to The Bourne Identity, and he directed Duplicity, which I know, Michael, you liked.
I did a lot, and Michael Clayton.
And yeah, those are two movies that I enjoyed a lot as well.
So our sympathies go to them and their, you know, his family and his children.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, to say, oh, his big success was the sub, hey, you had one, you know, had one iconic world-beating show. That's pretty damn great. It's not a slur on someone to say, why didn't he create more Pulitzer Prize-winning plays?
Yeah.
You know, that's just the towering achievement of his career. And that's
and besides,
great.
They tend not to, you know, give them to the same people over and over and over again.
Sure they do.
What? Pulitzer Prizes?
Tony's? Well, it's the Nobel is for the lifetime achievement. Pulitzer is for a thing. It doesn't go to not many people have won multiple Pulitzers for writing a theater piece. But yeah, they, you know, you win Tony's and Pulitzers multiple times. It's just the Nobel is for the lifetime achievement. That you only get once.
All right. Well, I'll work my way up to it then.
On a sadder note is Judy Carne, the Sakatumi girl on Laugh-In. She died at 76. And I was like, ah, Judy Carne. And you read her obituary. It's kind of sad.
Why is that?
She couldn't handle fame, drug addict, alcohol, shoplifting. She stole a copy of Harry Potter, I think it was, or something in a store and got caught. You know, not a great end to a life. Did not deal with success well.
She was using it as an instruction manual. She was trying to make it disappear.
And so, you know, it's, you know, we say, ah, why don't you handle your fame better? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? It ain't easy.
Apparently you know, not.
It ain't easy. That's for sure. And she was, you know, a absolute out of the box, crazy, enormous hit on Laugh-In, which was a crazy out of the box smash hit show. And she's like, Sakatumi. Suddenly everybody loved her. You know, then they forget you.
Well, speaking of cautionary tales, okay, what about Merv Adelson passing away at the age of 85?
That's right. He's a monster TV guy.
I mean, it's kind of hard to, I mean, this could be a whole segment unto itself.
That's right. I don't know whether this is like, yeah, that's a life, or whether you go, oh my God, be careful there. But for the grace of God, go me. He started in Vegas, probably with the mob. He opened a 24-hour grocery store. His dad gave him some money to start it up. Then he started building homes. Then somehow he ended up in TV. He helped launch Lorimar. And you probably recognize that name because they are a monster big company. They did their first thing that they ever did was a TV movie called The Homecoming, and that's became the Waltons. Massive TV hit, massive TV series hit. It almost didn't make it the first year. It was opposite the Flip Wilson Show and the Mod Squad, but they built and built and built that first season, hit the top 20, and then they were in the top 10, and they, you know, never left the air. It was a, you know, the biggest successful family show of all time for many, many decades. And of course they made multiple movies after that, but they did Alf, Eight Is Enough, Knots Landing. They did movies like Being There and Officer and a Gentleman. At one point, he was worth $300 million. Maybe one big TV show is the reason. Dallas. He did Dallas.
Yes.
He could live a long time off Dallas. And then he lost it all.
Well, because he invested in the Time Warner AOL merger.
It slaughtered him. He lost everything. He was married to Barbara Walters twice.
That's right. I think maybe he forgot. Was I married to you? Well, let's do it again just in case.
Yeah, that's right. At the end of his life, he was still trying to make deals, but he was broke and living modestly. And I do mean modestly. I don't mean Hollywood modestly. I mean, he was in a 500 square foot apartment in Santa Monica, but by God, he lived it up, didn't he?
Well, but you know what he would say is, hey, I'm in Santa Monica. Where are you? You know, in L.A., that says something.
There you go. So that's a hell of a life.
Yes. And this was a heck of a show. And if you liked the show, if you liked what you heard, please do go to iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you rate and review the show. And please subscribe. Also, write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to the show, all those ways to email us and call us, and all the stories we talked about, as well as ways to follow us at Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter and Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and up will come our page. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. They have their own website, which is whoismgmt.com. Every week, Michael Giltz has a brand new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
Bookfilter.com. I'm focused on Bookfilter.
Okay. I was going to say that is actually his website.
Go to Bookfilter.
So yes, go to bookfilter.com. You can read about all of Michael's fall suggestions there, fall releases, books, and I would imagine, well, books, really, right?
A lot of books
at bookfilter.com. Or you can go over to michaelgiltz.com to see some of his coverage of the entertainment industry, or Huffington Post. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.